Godwin thrust the money into the wallet at his belt, and left without another word. He hurried back to the cathedral and found Philemon in the treasury. "The nuns are going to carry out an audit," he explained breathlessly. "I've got the money back from Elfric. Open that chest, quickly." Philemon opened the vault in the floor, took out the chest, and removed the nails. He lifted the lid. Godwin sifted through the coins. They were all ducats. It could not be helped. He dug down into the money and pushed his florins to the bottom. "Close it up and put it back," he said. Philemon did so. Godwin felt a moment of relief. His crime was partly concealed. At least now it would not be glaringly obvious. "I want to be here when she counts it," he said to Philemon. "I'm worried about whether she'll notice that she's now got some florins mixed in with her ducats. Do you know when they intend to come?"
"No."
"I'll put a novice to sweeping the choir. When Beth shows up, he can come and fetch us." Philemon had a little coterie of admiring novice monks eager to do his bidding. However, the novice was not needed. As they were about to leave the treasury, Sister Beth and Sister Caris arrived. Godwin pretended to be in the middle of a conversation about accounts. "We'll have to look in an earlier account roll, brother," he said to Philemon. "Oh, good day, sisters." Caris opened both nuns' vaults and took out the two chests. "Something I can help you with?" Godwin said. Caris ignored him. Beth said, "We're just checking something, thank you, Father Prior. We won't be long." "Go ahead, go ahead," he said benevolently, though his heart was hammering in his chest. Caris said irritably, "There's no need to apologize for our being here, Sister Beth. It's our treasury and our money." Godwin opened an account roll at random, and he and Philemon pretended to study it. Beth and Caris counted the silver in the first chest, farthings, halfpennies, pennies, and a few Luxembourgs, forged pennies, crudely made of adulterated silver, and used as small change. There were a few assorted gold coins, too, florins, ducats, and similar coins, the Genovino from Genoa, and the Reale from Naples, plus some larger French moutons and new English nobles. Beth checked the totals against a small notebook. When they had finished, she said, "Exactly right." They replaced all the coins in the chest, locked it, and put it back in its underfloor vault. They began counting the gold coins in the other chest, putting them in piles of 10. When they got towards the bottom of the chest, Beth frowned and made a puzzled sound. "What is it?" Caris said. Godwin felt a guilty dread. Beth said, "This chest contains only the bequest from the pious woman of Thornbury. I kept it separate." "And?" "Her husband traded with Venice. I was sure the entire amount was in ducats, but there are some florins here, too." Godwin and Philemon froze, listening. "That's odd," Caris said. "Perhaps I made a mistake. It's a bit suspicious." "Not really," Beth said. "Thieves don't put money into your treasury, do they?" "You're right. They don't," Caris said reluctantly. They finished counting. They had 100 stacks of 10 coins worth £150. "That's the exact figure in my book," Beth said. "So, every pound and penny is correct," Caris said. Beth said, "I told you so." Chapter 45. Caris spent many hours thinking about Sister Mare. She had been startled by the kiss, but more surprised at her own reaction to it. She had found it exciting. Until now, she had not felt attracted to Mare or any other woman. In fact, there was only one person who had ever made her yearn to be touched and kissed and penetrated, and that was Merthyn. In the nunnery, she had learned to live without physical contact. The only hand that touched her sexually was her own, in the darkness of the dormitory, when she remembered the days of her courtship and buried her face in the pillow so that the other nuns would not hear her panting. She did not feel for Mare the same happy lust that Merthyn inspired in her. But Merthyn was 1,000 miles away and 7 years in the past. and she was fond of Mare. It was something to do with her angelic face, something about her blue eyes, some response to her gentleness in the hospital and the school. Mare always spoke sweetly to Caris, and, when no one was looking, touched her arm or her shoulder, and once her cheek. Caris did not rebuff her, but she held back from responding. It was not that she thought it would be a sin. She felt sure God was much too wise to make a rule against women harmlessly pleasuring themselves or each other. But she was afraid of disappointing Mare. Instinct told her that Mare's feelings were strong and definite, whereas her own were uncertain. "She's in love with me," Caris thought, "but I'm not in love with her. If I kiss her again, she may hope that the two of us will be soulmates for life, and I can't promise her that." So she did nothing until Fleece Fair week. The Kingsbridge Fair had recovered from the slump of 1338. The trade in raw wool was still suffering from interference by the king, and the Italians came only every second year, but the new business of weaving and dyeing compensated. The town was still not as prosperous as it might have been, for Prior Godwin's prohibition of private mills had driven the industry out of the city and into the surrounding villages. But most of the cloth was sold in the market. Indeed, it had become known as Kingsbridge Scarlet. Merthin's Bridge had been finished by Alfric, and people poured across the wide double span with their pack horses and wagons. So on the Saturday night before the official opening of the fair, the hospital was full to bursting with visitors. And one of them was ill. His name was Maldwyn Cook, and his trade was to make salty little savouries with flour and scraps of meat or fish, cook them quickly in butter over a fire, and sell them 6 for a farthing. Soon after he arrived, he was afflicted with a sudden, savage bellyache, followed by vomiting and diarrhoea. There was nothing Caris could do for him other than give him a bed near the door. She had long wanted to give the hospital its own latrine, so that she could supervise its cleanliness, but that was only one of the improvements she hoped for. She needed a new pharmacy, adjacent to the hospital, a spacious, well-lit room where she could prepare medicines and make her notes, and she was trying to figure out a way to give patients more privacy. At present, everyone in the room could see a woman giving birth, a man having a fit, a child vomiting. People in distress should have small rooms of their own, she felt, like the side chapels in a large church. But she was not sure how to achieve this. The hospital was not big enough. She had had several discussions with Jeremiah Builder, who had been Merthin's apprentice, Jimmy, many years ago, but he had not come up with a satisfactory solution. Next morning, 3 more people had the same symptoms as Maldwyn Cook. Caris fed the visitors breakfast and tipped them out into the market. Only the sick were allowed to stay behind. The floor of the hospital was filthier than usual, and she had it swept and swabbed. Then she went to the service in the cathedral. Bishop Richard was not present. He was with the king, preparing to invade France again. He had always regarded his bishopric mainly as a means of supporting his aristocratic lifestyle. In his absence, the diocese was run by Archdeacon Lloyd, who collected the bishop's tithes and rents, baptized children, and conducted services with dogged but unimaginative efficiency, a trait he illustrated by giving a tedious sermon on why God was more important than money, an odd note on which to open one of England's great commercial fairs. Nevertheless, everyone was in high spirits, as was usual on the first day. The Fleece Fair was the high point of the year for the townspeople and the peasants of the surrounding villages. People made money at the fair, and lost it gambling in the inns. Strapping village girls allowed themselves to be seduced by slick city boys. Prosperous peasants paid the town's prostitutes for services they dared not ask their wives to perform. There was usually a murder, often several. Caris spotted the heavy-set, richly dressed figure of Buonaventura Caroli in the congregation, and her heart faltered. He might have news of Merthin. She went through the service distractedly, mumbling the psalms. On the way out, she managed to catch Buonaventura's eye. He smiled at her. She tried to indicate, with an inclination of her head, that she wanted him to meet her afterwards. She was not sure whether he got the message. However, she went to the hospital, the only place in the priory where a nun could meet a man from outside, and Buenaventura came in not long afterwards. He wore a costly blue coat and pointed shoes. He said, "Last time I saw you, you had just been consecrated a nun by Bishop Richard." "I'm guest master now," she said. "Congratulations. I never expected you to take so well to convent life." Buenaventura had known her since she was a little girl. "Nor did I," she laughed. "The priory seems to be doing well." "What makes you say that?" "I see that Godwin is building a new palace." "Yes, he must be prospering." "I suppose he is. How about you? Is trade good?" "We have some problems. The war between England and France has disrupted transport, and your King Edward's taxes make English wool more expensive than the Spanish, but it's also better quality." They always complained about taxes. Caris came to the subject that really interested her. "Any news of Merthin?" "As a matter of fact, there is," Buenaventura said, and although his manner was as urbane as ever, she detected a hesitation. "Merthin is married." Caris felt as if she had been punched. She had never expected this, never even thought of it. How could Merthin do this? There was no reason at all why he should not get married, of course. She had rejected him more than once, and on the last occasion she had made her rejection final by entering the nunnery. It was only remarkable that he had waited so long. She had no right to feel hurt. She forced a smile. "How splendid," she said. "Please send him my congratulations. Who is the girl?" Buenaventura pretended not to notice her distress. "Her name is Silvia," he said, as casually as if he were passing on harmless gossip. "She's the younger daughter of one of the city's most prominent citizens, Alessandro Cristi, a trader in Oriental spices who owns several ships."
"How old?"
He grinned.
"Alessandro? He must be about my age. Don't tease me."
She was grateful to Buenaventura for lightening the tone. "How old is Silvia?"
23. 6 years younger than me.
A beautiful girl."
She sensed the unspoken qualification. "But..." He tilted his head to one side apologetically.
"She has the reputation of being sharp-tongued. Of course, people say all sorts of things, but perhaps that is why she remained single so long. Girls in Florence generally marry before the age of 18.
"I'm sure it's true," Caris said. "The only girls Merthin liked in Kingsbridge were me and Elizabeth Clark, and we're both shrews."
Buenaventura laughed.
"Not so, not so."
"When was the wedding?"
2 years ago, not long after I last saw you."
Caris realized that Merthin had remained single until she had been consecrated as a nun. He would have heard, via Buenaventura, that she had taken the final step. She thought of him waiting and hoping for more than 4 years in a foreign country, and her brittle facade of good cheer began to crack. Buenaventura said, "And they have a child, a little baby girl called Lola." That was too much. All the grief Caris had felt 7 years ago, the pain she thought had gone forever, came back in a rush. She had not truly lost him back then in 1339, she realized. He had remained loyal to her memory for years. But she had lost him now, finally, eternally. She was shaken as if by a fit, and she knew she could not hold out much longer. Trembling, she said,
"It's such a pleasure to see you, and catch up with the news. But I must get back to my work."
His face showed concern. "I hope I haven't upset you too much.
I thought you would prefer to know."
"Don't be kind to me. I can't stand it."
She turned from him and hurried away. She bent her head to hide her face as she walked from the hospital into the cloisters. Searching for somewhere to be alone, she ran up the stairs to the dormitory. There was no one there in the daytime. She began to sob as she walked the length of the bare room. At the far end was Mother Cecilia's bedroom. No one was allowed in there without an invitation, but Caris went in anyway, slamming the door behind her. She fell on Cecilia's bed, not caring that her nun's cap had fallen off. She buried her face in the straw mattress and wept. After a while, she felt a hand on her head, stroking her short, cropped hair. She had not heard the person enter the room. She did not care who it was. All the same, she was slowly, gradually soothed. Her sobs became less wrenching, her tears dried, and the storm of her emotions began to die down. She rolled over and looked up at her comforter. It was Mare. Caris said,
"Merthyn is married. He has a baby girl."
She began to cry again. Mare lay down on the bed and cradled Caris's head in her arms. Caris pressed her face into Mare's soft breasts, letting the woolen robe soak up the tears.
"There, there," said Mare.
After a while, Caris calmed down. She was too drained to feel any more sorrow. She thought of Merthyn holding a dark-haired little Italian baby, and saw how happy he would be. She was glad that he was happy, and she drifted into an exhausted sleep. The illness that had started with Maldwyn Cook spread like a summer fire through the crowds at the Fleece Fair. On Monday, it leaped from the hospital to the taverns, then on Tuesday, from the visitors to the townspeople. Caris noted its characteristics in her book. It began with stomach pains, led quickly to vomiting and diarrhea, and lasted between 24 and 48 hours. It left adults not much the worse, but killed old people and small babies. On Wednesday, it struck the nuns and the children in the girls' school. Both Mare and Tilly were affected. Caris sought out Buonaventura at the Bell, and worriedly asked him whether Italian doctors had any treatment for such diseases.
"There's no cure," he said. "None that works, anyway, though doctors nearly always prescribe something just to get more money out of people. But some Arab physicians believe you can retard the spread of such illnesses."
"Oh, really?" Caris was interested. Traders said that Muslim doctors were superior to their Christian counterparts, although the priest physicians denied this hotly.
"How?"
"They believe the disease is acquired when a sick person looks at you. Sight functions by beams that issue from the eyes and touch the things we see, rather like extending a finger to feel whether something is warm or dry or hard. But the beams may also project sickness. Therefore, you can avoid the disease by never being in the same room as a sufferer."
Caris did not think illness could be transmitted by looks. If that were true, then, after an important service in the cathedral, everyone in the congregation would acquire any illness the bishop had. Whenever the king was ill, he would infect all the hundreds of people who saw him, and surely someone would have noticed that. However, the notion that you should not share a room with someone who was ill did seem convincing. Here in the hospital, Maldwyn's illness seemed to spread from a sufferer to those nearby. The sick man's wife and family were the first to catch it, followed by people in neighboring beds. She had also observed that certain kinds of illness, stomach upsets, coughs and colds and poxes of all sorts, seemed to flare up during fairs and markets, so it seemed obvious that they were passed from one person to another by some means. On Wednesday night at supper, half the guests in the hospital were suffering from the illness. Then by Thursday morning, every one of them had it. Several priory servants also succumbed, so Caris was short of people to clean up. Surveying the chaos at breakfast time, Mother Cecilia suggested closing the hospital. Caris was ready to consider anything. She felt dismayed at her own powerlessness to combat the disease and devastated by the filth of her hospital. "But where would the people sleep?" she said. "Send them to the taverns. The taverns have the same problem. We could put them in the cathedral." Cecilia shook her head.
Godwin won't have peasants puking in the nave while services go on in the choir. Wherever they sleep, we ought to separate the sick from the well. That's the way to retard the spread of the illness, according to Buenaventura. It makes sense. Caris was struck by a new idea, something that suddenly seemed very obvious, though she had not thought of it before. Perhaps we shouldn't just improve the hospital, she said. Maybe we should build a new one, just for sick people, and keep the old one for pilgrims and other healthy visitors. Cecilia looked thoughtful. It would be costly. We've got £150. Caris's imagination began to work. It could incorporate a new pharmacy. We could have private rooms for people who are chronically ill. Find out what it would cost. You could ask Elfric. Caris hated Elfric. She had disliked him even before he had given evidence against her. She did not want him to build her new hospital. Elfric is busy building Godwin's new palace, she said. I'd rather consult Jeremiah. By all means. Caris felt a rush of affection for Cecilia. Although she was a martinet, tough on discipline, she gave her deputies room to make their own decisions. She had always understood the conflicting passions that drove Caris. Instead of trying to suppress those passions, Cecilia had found ways to make use of them. She had given Caris work that engaged her and provided outlets for her rebellious energy. Here I am, Caris thought, plainly incapable of dealing with the crisis in front of me, and my superior is calmly telling me to forge ahead with a new long-term project. Thank you, Mother Cecilia, she said. Later that day, she walked around the priory grounds with Jeremiah and explained her aspirations. He was as superstitious as ever, seeing the work of saints and devils in the most trivial of everyday incidents. Nevertheless, he was an imaginative builder, open to new ideas. He had learned from Merthyn. They quickly settled on the best location for the new hospital, immediately to the south of the existing kitchen block. It would be apart from the rest of the buildings, so that sick people would have less contact with the healthy, but food would not have to be carried far, and the new building could still be accessed conveniently from the nuns' cloisters. With the pharmacy, the new latrines, and an upper floor with private rooms, Jeremiah thought it would cost about £100, most of the legacy. Caris discussed the site with Mother Cecilia. It was land that belonged neither to the monks nor the nuns, so they went to see Godwin about it. They found him on the site of his own building project, the new palace. The shell was up and the roof was on. Caris had not visited the site for some weeks, and she was surprised at its size. It was going to be as big as her new hospital. She saw why Buenaventura had called it impressive. The dining hall was larger than the nuns' refectory. The site was swarming with workmen, as if Godwin was in a hurry to get it finished. Masons were laying a floor of colored tiles in a geometric pattern. Several carpenters were making doors, and a master glazier had set up a furnace to make the windows. Godwin was spending a lot of money. He and Philemon were showing the new building to Archdeacon Lloyd, the bishop's deputy. Godwin broke off as the nuns approached. Cecilia said, "Don't let us interrupt you, but when you're finished, will you meet me outside the hospital? There's something I need to show you." "By all means," said Godwin. Caris and Cecilia walked back through the marketplace in front of the cathedral. Friday was bargain day at the Fleece Fair, when traders sold their remaining stocks at reduced prices, so that they would not have to carry the goods home. Caris saw Mark Webber, round-faced and round-bellied now, wearing a coat of his own bright scarlet. His four children were helping at his stall. Caris was specially fond of Nora, now 15, who had her mother's bustling confidence in a slimmer body. "You're looking prosperous," Caris said to Mark with a smile. "The wealth should have come to you," he replied. "You invented the dye. I just did what you said. I almost feel as if I cheated you." "You've been rewarded for hard work," she said. She did not mind that Mark and Madge had done so well out of her invention. Although she had always enjoyed the challenge of doing business, she had never lusted for money, perhaps because she had always taken it for granted, growing up in her father's wealthy household. Whatever the reason, she felt no pang of regret that the Webbers were making a fortune that might have been hers. The cashless life of the Priory seemed to suit her well, and she was thrilled to see the Webber children healthy and well-dressed. She remembered when all six of them had to find sleeping space on the floor of a single room, most of which was taken up by a loom. She and Cecilia went to the south end of the Priory grounds. The land around the stables looked like a farmyard. There were a few small buildings, a dovecot, a henhouse, and a tool shed. Chickens scratched in the dirt, and pigs rooted in the kitchen garbage. Carys itched to tidy it up. Godwin and Philemon joined them soon, with Lloyd tagging along. Cecilia indicated the patch of land next to the kitchens, and said, "I'm going to build a new hospital, and I want to put it there. What do you think?" "A new hospital," Godwin said. "Why?" Carys thought he looked anxious, which puzzled her. Cecilia said, "We want a hospital for the sick, and a separate guest house for healthy visitors." "What an extraordinary idea! It's because of the stomach illness that started with Maldwyn Cook. This is a particularly virulent example, but diseases often flare up at markets, and part of the reason they spread so fast may be that we have the sick and the well eating and sleeping and going to the latrine together." Godwin took umbrage. "Oh-ho!" he said. "So the nuns are the physicians now, are they?" Carys frowned. This kind of sneering was not Godwin's style. He used charm to get his way, especially with powerful people such as Cecilia. This fit of pique was covering something else. "Of course not," Cecilia said. "But we all know that some illnesses spread from one sufferer to the next. That's obvious." Carys put in, "The Muslim physicians believe illness is transmitted by looking at the sick person." "Oh, do they? How interesting." Godwin spoke with ponderous sarcasm. "Those of us who have spent 7 years studying medicine at the university are always glad to be lectured on illness by young nuns barely out of their novitiate." Carys was not intimidated. She felt no inclination to show respect to a lying hypocrite who had tried to murder her. She said, "If you don't believe in the transmission of illness, why don't you prove your sincerity by coming to the hospital tonight and sleeping alongside 100 people suffering from nausea and diarrhea?" Cecilia said, "Sister Carys, that will be enough." She turned to Godwin. "Forgive her, Father Prior. It wasn't my intention to engage you in a discussion about disease with a mere nun. I just want to make sure you don't object to my choice of site." "You can't build it now anyway," Godwin said. "Elfric is too busy with the palace." Carys said, "We don't want Elfric. We're using Jeremiah." Cecilia turned on her. "Carys, be quiet. Remember your place. Don't interrupt my conversation with the Lord Prior again." Carys realized she was not helping Cecilia, and, against her inclination, she lowered her head and said, "I'm sorry, Mother Prioress." Cecilia said to Godwin, "The question is not when we build, it's where." "I'm afraid I don't approve of this," he said stiffly. "Where would you prefer the new building to be sited? I don't think you need a new hospital at all." "Forgive me, but I am in charge of the nunnery," Cecilia said with asperity. "You can't tell me how I should spend our money. However, we normally consult one another before putting up new buildings, although it has to be said that you forgot this little courtesy when planning your palace. Nevertheless, I am consulting you merely on the question of the location of the building." She looked at Lloyd. "I'm sure the Archdeacon will agree with me on this." "There must be agreement," Lloyd said non-committally. Carys frowned, baffled. Why did Godwin care? He was building his palace on the north side of the cathedral. It made no difference to him if the nuns put up a new building down here in the south, where most monks hardly ever came. What was he worried about? Godwin said, I'm telling you that I do not approve of the location nor of the building, so that is the end of the matter.
Karras suddenly saw, in a flash of inspiration, the reason for Godwin's behavior. She was so shocked that she blurted it out.
You stole our money!
Cecilia said, Karras, I told you he's stolen the legacy of the Woman of Thornbury, Karras said, overriding Cecilia in her outrage. That's where he got the money for his palace, of course! And now he's trying to stop us building, because he knows we'll go to the treasury and find that our money has vanished. She felt so indignant she might burst. Godwin said, Don't be preposterous. As a response, it was so muted that Karras knew she must have touched a nerve. Confirmation made her even angrier.
Prove it! She yelled.
She forced herself to speak more calmly. We'll go to the treasury now and check the vaults. You wouldn't object to that, would you, Father Prior?
Philemon chipped in. It would be a completely undignified proceeding, and there is no question of the prior submitting himself to it.
Karras ignored him. There should be £150 in gold in the nun's reserves.
Out of the question, said Godwin.
Karras said, Well, clearly the nuns will have to check the vaults anyway, now that the accusation has been made. She looked at Cecilia, who nodded in agreement. So, if the prior prefers not to be present, no doubt the archdeacon will be happy to attend as a witness.
Lloyd looked as if he would have preferred not to get involved in this dispute, but it was hard for him to refuse to play the role of umpire, so he muttered, If I can help both sides, of course.
Karras's mind was racing on. How did you open the chest? She said. Christopher Blacksmith made the lock, and he's too honest to give you a duplicate key and help you steal from us. You must have broken the box open, then repaired it somehow. What did you do? Take off the hinge?
She saw Godwin glance involuntarily at his sub-prior.
Ah,
Karras said triumphantly. So Philemon took the hinge off, but the prior took the money and gave it to Alfric.
Cecilia said, Enough speculation. Let's settle the matter. We'll all go to the treasury and open the box, and that will be an end to it.
Godwin said, It wasn't stealing. Everyone stared at him. There was a shocked silence. Cecilia said,
You're admitting it.
It wasn't stealing, Godwin repeated. The money is being used for the benefit of the priory and the glory of God.
Karras said,
It makes no difference. It wasn't your money. It's God's money,
Godwin said stubbornly.
Cecilia said, It was left to the nunnery. You know that. You saw the will.
I know nothing of any will.
Of course you do. I gave it to you to make a copy.
Cecilia tailed off.
Godwin said again, I know nothing of any will.
Karras said, He's destroyed it. He said he would make a copy and put the original in the chest, in the treasury, but he destroyed it.
Cecilia was staring open-mouthed at Godwin.
I should have known, she said, after what you tried to do to Karras. I should never have trusted you again, but I thought your soul might yet have been saved. I was so wrong.
Karras said, It's a good thing we made our own copy of the will before handing it over. She was inventing this in desperation.
Godwin said, A forgery, obviously.
Karras said, If the money was yours in the first place, you will have had no need to break open the casket to get it. So let's go and look. That will settle it one way or another.
Philemon said, The fact that the hinge has been tampered with proves nothing.
So I was right, said Karras. But how do you know about the hinge? Sister Bess has not opened the vault since the audit, and the box was fine then. You must have removed it from the vault yourself, if you know that it has been interfered with.
Philemon looked bewildered, and had no answer. Cecilia turned to Lloyd.
Archdeacon, you are the bishop's representative. I think it's your duty to order the prior to return this money to the nuns.
Lloyd looked worried. He said to Godwin, "Have you got any of the money left?"
Carys said furiously, "When you've caught a thief, you don't ask him whether he can afford to relinquish his ill-gotten gains."
Godwin said, "More than half has already been spent on the palace."
"Building must stop immediately," Carys said. "The men must be dismissed today, the building torn down and the material sold. You have to return every penny. What you can't pay in cash, after the palace has been demolished, you must make up in land or other assets."
"I refuse," Godwin said.
Cecilia addressed Lloyd again.
"Archdeacon, please do your duty. You cannot allow one of the bishop's subordinates to steal from another, no matter that they both do God's work."
Lloyd said, "I can't adjudicate a dispute such as this myself. It's too serious." Carys was speechless with fury and dismay at Lloyd's weakness. Cecilia protested,
"But you must!"
He looked trapped, but he shook his head stubbornly. "Accusations of theft, destruction of a will, a charge of forgery? This must go to the bishop himself."
Cecilia said, "But Bishop Richard is on his way to France, and no one knows when he will be back. Meanwhile, Godwin is spending the stolen money."
"I can't help that, I'm afraid," Lloyd said. "You must appeal to Richard."
"Very well, then," said Carys. Something in her tone made them all look at her.
"In that case, there's only one thing to do. We'll go and find our bishop."
Chapter 46. In July of 1346, King Edward III assembled the largest invasion fleet England had ever seen, almost 1,000 ships, at Portsmouth. Contrary winds delayed the armada, but they finally set sail on the 11th of July, their destination a secret. Carys and Mare arrived in Portsmouth 2 days later, just missing Bishop Richard, who had sailed with the king. They decided to follow the army to France. It had not been easy to get approval even for the trip to Portsmouth. Mother Cecilia had invited the nuns in chapter to discuss the proposal, and some had felt that Carys would be in moral and physical danger. But nuns did leave their convents, not just on pilgrimages, but on business errands to London, Canterbury, and Rome, and the Kingsbridge sisters wanted their stolen money back. However, Carys was not sure she would have got permission to cross the Channel. Fortunately, she was not able to ask. She and Mare could not have followed the army immediately, even if they had known the king's destination, because every seaworthy vessel on the south coast of England had been commandeered for the invasion. So they fretted with impatience at a nunnery just outside Portsmouth and waited for news. Carys learned later that King Edward and his army disembarked on a broad beach at St. Vaast-la-Hogue, on the north coast of France near Barfleur. However, the fleet did not return immediately. Instead, the ships followed the coast eastward for 2 weeks, tracking the invading army as far as Cayenne. There they loaded their holds with booty, jewelry, expensive cloth, and gold and silver plate looted by Edward's army from the prosperous burgesses of Normandy. Then they returned. One of the first back was the Grace, which was a cog, a broad-built cargo ship with rounded prow and stern. Her captain, a leather-faced salt called Rollo, was full of praise for the king. He had been paid at scarcity rates for his ship and his men, and he had gained a good share of the plunder himself.
"Biggest army I've ever seen," Rollo said with relish.
He thought there were at least 15,000 men, about half of them archers, and probably 5,000 horses.
"You'll have your work cut out to catch up with them," he said. "I'll take you to Cayenne, the last place I know them to have been, and you can pick up their trail there. Whatever direction they've taken, they'll be about a week ahead of you."
Carys and Mare negotiated a price with Rollo, then went aboard the Grace with 2 sturdy ponies, Blackie and Stamp. They could not travel any faster than the army's horses, but the army had to stop and fight every so often, Carys reasoned,
and that should enable her to catch up. When they reached the French side and sailed into the estuary of the Orne, early on a sunny August morning, Carrie sniffed the breeze and noticed the unpleasant smell of old ashes. Studying the landscape on either side of the river, she saw that the farmland was black. It looked as if the crops had been burned in the fields.
"Standard practice," Rollo said. "What the army can't take must be destroyed. Otherwise it could benefit the enemy."
As they neared the port of Cayenne, they passed the hulks of several burned-out ships, presumably fired for the same reason.
"No one knows the king's plan," Rollo told them. "He may go south and advance on Paris, or swing northeast to Calais, and hope to meet up there with his Flemish allies. But you'll be able to follow his trail. Just keep the blackened fields on either side of you."
Before they disembarked, Rollo gave them a ham.
"Thank you, but we've got some smoked fish and hard cheese in our saddlebags," Carys said to him, "and we have money. We can buy anything else we need."
"Money may not be much use to you," the captain replied. "There may be nothing to buy. An army is like a plague of locusts. It strips the country bare. Take the ham."
"You're very kind. Goodbye."
"Pray for me, if you would, sister. I've committed some heavy sins in my time."
Cayenne was a city of several thousand houses. Like Kingsbridge, its two halves, Old Town and New Town, were divided by a river, the Odon, which was spanned by St. Peter's Bridge. On the riverbank near the bridge, a few fishermen were selling their catch. Carys asked the price of an eel. She found the answer difficult to understand. The fisherman spoke a dialect of French she had never heard. When at last she was able to make out what he was saying, the price took her breath away. Food was so scarce, she realized, that it was more precious than jewels. She was grateful for Rollo's generosity. They had decided that if they were questioned, they would say there were Irish nuns traveling to Rome. Now, however, as she and Mare rode away from the river, Carys wondered nervously whether local people would know from her accent that she was English. There were not many local people to be seen. Broken-down doors and smashed shutters revealed empty houses. There was a ghostly hush. No vendors crying their wares, no children quarrelling, no church bells. The only work being done was burial. The battle had taken place more than a week ago, but small groups of grim-faced men were still bringing corpses out of buildings and loading them onto carts. It looked as if the English army had simply massacred men, women, and children. They passed a church where a huge pit had been dug in the churchyard, and saw the bodies being tipped into a mass grave, without coffins or even shrouds, while a priest intoned a continuous burial service. The stench was unspeakable. A well-dressed man bowed to them and asked if they needed assistance. His proprietorial manner suggested that he was a leading citizen, concerned to make sure no harm came to religious visitors. Carys declined his offer of help, noting that his Norman French was no different from that of a nobleman in England. Perhaps, she thought, the lower orders all had their different local dialects, while the ruling class spoke with an international accent. The two nuns took the road east out of town, glad to leave the haunted streets behind. The countryside was deserted too. The bitter taste of ash was always on Carys's tongue. Many of the fields and orchards on either side of the road had been fired. Every few miles they rode through a heap of charred ruins that had been a village. The peasants had either fled before the army or died in the conflagration, for there was little life, just the birds, the occasional pig or chicken overlooked by the army's foragers, and sometimes a dog nosing through the debris in a bewildered way, trying to pick up the scent of its master in a pile of cold embers. Their immediate destination was a nunnery half a day's ride from Cayenne. Whenever possible, they would spend the night at a religious house, nunnery, monastery, or hospital, as they had on the way from Kingsbridge to Portsmouth. They knew the names and locations of 51 such institutions between Cayenne and Paris. If they could find them, as they hurried in the scorched footprints of King Edward, their accommodation and food would be free, and they would be safe from thieves, And, Mother Cecilia would add, from fleshly temptations, such as strong drink and male company. Cecilia's instincts were sharp, but she had not sensed that a different kind of temptation was in the air between Caris and Mare. Because of that, Caris had at first refused Mare's request to come with her. She was focused on moving fast, and she did not want to complicate her mission by entering into a passionate entanglement, or by refusing so to do. On the other hand, she needed someone courageous and resourceful as her companion. Now she was glad of her choice. Of all the nuns, Mare was the only one with the guts to go chasing the English army through France. She had planned to have a frank talk before they left, saying that there should be no physical affection between them while they were away. Apart from anything else, they could get into terrible trouble if they were seen. But somehow, she had never got around to the frank talk. So here they were in France with the issue still hanging unmentioned, like an invisible third traveller riding between them on a silent horse. They stopped at midday by a stream on the edge of a wood, where there was an unburned meadow for the ponies to graze. Caris cut slices from Rollo's ham, and Mare took from their baggage a loaf of stale bread from Portsmouth. They drank the water from the stream, though it had the taste of cinders. Caris suppressed her eagerness to get going, and forced herself to let the horses rest for the hottest hour of the day. Then, as they were getting ready to leave, she was startled to see someone watching her. She froze, with the ham in one hand and her knife in the other. Mare said, "What is it?" Then she followed Caris's gaze and understood. Two men stood a few yards away, in the shade of the trees, staring at them. They looked quite young, but it was hard to be sure, for their faces were sooty and their clothing was filthy. After a moment, Caris spoke to them in Norman French. "God bless you, my children." They made no reply. Caris guessed they were unsure what to do. But what possibilities were they considering? Robbery? Rape? They had a predatory look. She was scared, but she made herself think calmly. Whatever else they might want, they must be starving, she calculated. She said to Mare, "Quickly, give me two trenchers of that bread." Mare cut two thick slices off the big loaf. Caris cut corresponding slabs from the ham. She put the ham on the bread, then said to Mare, "Give them one each." Mare looked terrified, but she walked across the grass with an unhesitating step and offered the food to the men. They both snatched it and began to wolf it down. Caris thanked her stars that she had guessed right. She quickly put the ham in her saddlebag and the knife in her belt, then climbed on to Blackie. Mare followed suit, stowing the bread and mounting Stamp. Caris felt safer on horseback. The taller of the two men came towards them, moving quickly. Caris was tempted to kick her pony and take off, but she did not quite have time. And then the man's hand was holding her bridle. He spoke through a mouthful of food.
"Thank you,"
he said with the heavy local accent. Caris said, "Thank God, not me. He sent me to help you. He is watching over you. He sees everything."
"You have more meat in your bag."
"God will tell me who to give it to." There was a pause while the man thought that over. Then he said,
"Give me your blessing."
Caris was reluctant to extend her right arm in the traditional gesture of blessing. It would take her hand too far away from the knife at her belt. It was only a short-bladed food knife of the kind carried by every man and woman, but it was enough to slash the back of the hand that held her bridle and cause the man to let go. Then she was inspired. "Very well," she said. "Kneel down." The man hesitated. "You must kneel to receive my blessing," she said in a slightly raised voice. Slowly the man knelt, still holding his food in his hand. Caris turned her gaze on his companion. After a moment, the second man did the same. Caris blessed them both, then kicked Blackie and quickly trotted away. After a moment she looked back. Mare was close behind her. The two starving men stood staring at them. Caris mulled over the incident anxiously as they rode through the afternoon. The sun shone cheerfully, as on a fine day in hell. In some places, smoke was rising fitfully from a patch of woodland or a smouldering barn. But the countryside was not totally deserted, she realized gradually. She saw a pregnant woman harvesting beans in a field that had escaped the English torches, the scared faces of two children looking out from the blackened stones of a manor house, and several small groups of men, usually flitting through the fringes of woodland, moving with the alert purposefulness of scavengers. The men worried her. They looked hungry, and hungry men were dangerous. She wondered whether she should stop fretting about speed and worry instead about safety. Finding their way to the religious houses where they planned to stop was also going to be more difficult than Caris had thought. She had not anticipated that the English army would leave such devastation in its wake. She had assumed there would be peasants around to direct her. It could be hard enough in normal times to get such information from people who had never travelled farther than the nearest market town. Now her interlocutors would also be elusive, terrified, or predatory. She knew by the sun that she was heading east, and she thought, judging by the deep cartwheel ruts in the baked mud, that she was on the main road. Tonight's destination was a village named, after the nunnery at its center, Hôpital des Sœurs. As the shadow in front of her grew longer, she looked about with increasing urgency for someone whom she could ask for directions. Children fled from their approach in fear. Caris was not yet desperate enough to risk getting close to the hungry-looking men. She hoped to come across a woman. There were no young women anywhere, and Caris had a bleak suspicion about the fate they might have met at the hands of the marauding English. Occasionally she saw, in the far distance, a few lonely figures harvesting a field that had escaped burning, but she was reluctant to go too far from the road. At last, they found a wrinkled old woman sitting under an apple tree next to a substantial stone house. She was eating small apples wrenched from the tree long before they were ripe. She looked terrified. Caris dismounted, to seem less intimidating. The old woman tried to hide her poor meal in the folds of her dress, but she seemed not to have the strength to run away. Caris addressed her politely. "Good evening, Mother. Will this road take us to Hôpital des Sœurs, may I ask?" The woman seemed to pull herself together and answered intelligently. Pointing in the direction in which they were heading, she said, "Through the woods and over the hill." Caris saw that she had no teeth. It must have been almost impossible to eat unripe apples with your gums, she thought with pity. "How far?" she asked. "A long way." All distances were long at her age. "Can we get there by nightfall?"
"On a horse?"
"Yes." "Thank you, Mother."
"I had a daughter," said the old woman, "and two grandsons, 14 years and 16. Fine boys."
"I'm very sorry to hear that."
"The English," said the old woman, "may they all burn in hell."
Evidently it did not occur to her that Caris and Mare might be English. That answered Caris's question. Local people could not tell the nationality of strangers. "What were the boys' names, Mother?"
"Gilles and Jean."
"I will pray for the souls of Gilles and Jean."
"Have you any bread?"
Caris looked around to make sure there was no one else lurking nearby, ready to pounce, but they were alone. She nodded to Mare, who took from her saddlebag the remains of the loaf and offered it to the old woman. The woman snatched it from her and began to gnaw it with her gums. Caris and Mare rode away. Mare said,
"If we keep giving our food away, we're going to starve."
"I know," said Caris, "but how can you refuse?
We can't fulfill our mission if we're dead."
"But we are nuns, after all," Caris said with asperity. "We must help the needy, and leave it to God to decide when it's time for us to die." Mare was startled.
"I've never heard you talk like that before."
"My father hated people who preached about morality. We're all good when it suits us," he used to say. "That doesn't count. It's when you want so badly to do something wrong, when you're about to make a fortune from a dishonest deal, or kiss the lovely lips of your neighbor's wife, or tell a lie to get yourself out of terrible trouble. That's when you need the rules. Your integrity is like a sword, he would say. You shouldn't wave it until you're about to put it to the test. Not that he knew anything about swords. Mare was silent for a while. She might have been mulling over what Karis had said, or she might simply have given up the argument. Karis was not sure. Talk of Edmund always made Karis realize how much she missed him. After her mother died, he had become the cornerstone of her life. He had always been there, standing at her shoulder, as it were, ready when she needed sympathy and understanding, or shrewd advice, or just information. He had known so much about the world. Now, when she turned in that direction, there was just an empty space. They passed through a patch of woodland, then breasted a rise, as the old woman had forecast. Looking down on a shallow valley, they saw another burned village, the same as all the rest, but for a cluster of stone buildings that looked like a small convent. "This must be Hôpital des Sœurs," said Karis. "Thank God." She realized, as she approached, how used to nunnery life she had become. As they rode down the hill, she found herself looking forward to the ritual washing of hands, a meal taken in silence, bedtime at nightfall, even the sleepy peacefulness of matins at 3 o'clock in the morning. After what she had seen today, the security of those grey stone walls was alluring, and she kicked the tired blackie into a trot. There was no one moving about the place, but that was not really surprising. It was a small house in a village, and you would not expect the kind of hustle and bustle seen at a major priory such as Kingsbridge. Still, at this time of day, there should have been a column of smoke from a kitchen fire as the evening meal was prepared. However, as she came closer, she saw further ominous signs, and a sense of dismay slowly engulfed her. The nearest building, which looked like a church, appeared to have no roof. The windows were empty sockets, lacking shutters or glass. Some of the stone walls were blackened as if by smoke. The place was silent. No bells, no cries of ostlers or kitchen hands. It was deserted, Karis realized despondently as she reined in, and it had been fired, like every other building in the village. Most of the stone walls were still standing, but the timber roofs had fallen in, doors and other woodwork had burned, and glass windows had shattered in the heat. Mayor said unbelievingly, "They set fire to a nunnery?" Karis was equally shocked. She had believed that invading armies invariably left ecclesiastical buildings intact. It was an iron rule, people said. A commander would not hesitate to put to death a soldier who violated a holy place. She had accepted that without question. "So much for chivalry," she said. They dismounted and walked, stepping cautiously around charred beams and scorched rubble to the domestic quarters. As they approached the kitchen door, Mare gave a shriek and said, "Oh God, what's that?" Karis knew the answer. "It's a dead nun." The corpse on the ground was naked, but had the cropped hair of a nun. The body had somehow survived the fire. The woman was about a week dead. The birds had already eaten her eyes, and parts of her face had been nibbled by some scavenging animal. Also, her breasts had been cut off with a knife. Mare said in amazement, "Did the English do this?" "Well, it wasn't the French. Our soldiers have foreigners fighting alongside them, don't they? Welshmen and Germans and so on. Perhaps it was them." "They're all under the orders of our king," Karis said with grim disapprobation. "He brought them here. What they do is his responsibility." They stared at the hideous sight. As they looked, a mouse came out of the corpse's mouth. Mare screamed and turned away. Karis hugged her. "Calm down," she said firmly, but she stroked Mare's back to comfort her. "Come on," she said after a moment. "Let's get away from here." They returned to their horses. Karis resisted an impulse to bury the dead nun. If they delayed,
they would still be here at nightfall. But where were they to go? They had planned to spend the night here. "We'll go back to the old woman with the apple tree," she said. "Her house is the only intact building we've seen since we left Cayenne." She glanced anxiously at the setting sun. "If we push the horses, we can be there before it's full dark." They urged their tired ponies forward and headed back along the road. Directly ahead of them, the sun sank all too quickly below the horizon. The last of the light was fading when they arrived back at the house by the apple tree. The old woman was happy to see them, expecting them to share their food, which they did, eating in the dark. Her name was Jeanne. There was no fire, but the weather was mild, and the three women rolled up side by side in their blankets. Not fully trusting their hostess, Caris and Mare lay down clutching the saddlebags that contained their food. Caris lay awake for a while. She was pleased to be on the move after such a long delay in Portsmouth, and they had made good progress in the last 2 days. If she could find Bishop Richard, she felt sure he would force Godwin to repay the nun's money. He was no paragon of integrity, but he was open-minded, and in his lackadaisical way he dispensed justice even-handedly. Godwin had not had things all his own way, even in the witchcraft trial. She felt sure she could persuade Richard to give her a letter, ordering Godwin to sell Priory assets in order to give back the stolen cash. But she was worried about her safety and Mare's. Her assumption that soldiers would leave nuns alone had been quite wrong. What they had seen at Hôpital des Sœurs had made that clear. She and Mare needed a disguise. When she woke up at first light, she said to Jeanne, "Your grandsons, do you still have their clothes?" The old woman opened a wooden chest. "Take what you want," she said. "I have no one to give them to." She picked up a bucket and went off to fetch water. Caris began to sort through the garments in the chest. Jeanne had not asked for payment. Clothes had little monetary value after so many people had died, she guessed. Mare said, "What are you up to?" "Nuns aren't safe," Caris said. "We're going to become pages in the service of a minor lord, Pierre, Sieur of Longchamp in Brittany. Pierre is a common name, and there must be lots of places called Longchamp. Our master has been captured by the English, and our mistress has sent us to find him and negotiate his ransom." "All right," Mare said eagerly. "Gilles and Jean were 14 and 16, so with luck their clothes will fit us." Caris picked out a tunic, leggings, and a cape with a hood, all in the dull brown of undyed wool. Mare found a similar outfit in green, with short sleeves and an undershirt. Women did not usually wear underdrawers, but men did, and fortunately, Jeanne had lovingly washed the linen garments of her dead family. Caris and Mare could keep their own shoes. The practical footwear of nuns was no different from what men wore. "Shall we put them on?" said Mare. They pulled off their nuns' robes. Caris had never seen Mare undressed, and she could not resist a peek. Her companion's naked body took her breath away. Mare's skin seemed to glow like a pink pearl. Her breasts were generous with pale, girlish nipples, and she had a luxuriant bush of fair pubic hair. Caris was suddenly conscious that her own body was not as beautiful. She looked away and quickly began to put on the clothes she had chosen. She pulled the tunic over her head. It was just like a woman's dress, except that it stopped at the knee instead of the ankles. She pulled up the linen underdrawers and the leggings, then put her shoes and belt back on. Mare said, "How do I look?" Caris studied her. Mare had put a boy's cap over her short blonde hair and tilted it at an angle. She was grinning. "You look so happy," Caris said in surprise. "I've always liked boys' clothes." Mare swaggered up and down the small room. "This is how they walk," she said, "always taking more space than they need." It was such an accurate imitation that Caris burst out laughing. Caris was struck by a thought. "Are we going to have to pee standing up? I can do it, but not in undershorts. Too inaccurate." Caris giggled. We can't leave off the drawers. A sudden flurry of wind could expose our pretenses. Mare laughed. Then she began to stare at Caris in a way that was strange, but not entirely unfamiliar, looking her up and down, meeting her eyes and holding her gaze. "What are you doing?" said Caris. "This is how men look at women, as if they own us. But be careful. If you do it to a man, he becomes aggressive." "This could be more difficult than I thought." "You're too beautiful," Mare said. "You need a dirty face." She went to the fireplace and blackened her hand with soot. Then she smeared it on Caris's face. Her touch was like a caress. "My face isn't beautiful," Caris thought. "No one ever judged it so. Except Merthin, of course." "Too much," Mare said after a minute, and wiped some off with her other hand. "That's better." She smeared Caris's hand and said, "Now do me." Caris spread a faint smudge on Mare's jawline and throat, making it look as if she might have a light beard. It felt very intimate, to be looking so hard at her face and touching her skin so softly. She dirtied Mare's forehead and cheeks. Mare looked like a pretty boy, but she did not look like a woman. They studied one another. A smile played on the red bow of Mare's lips. Caris felt a sense of anticipation, as if something momentous was about to happen. Then a voice said, "Where are the nuns?" They both turned around guiltily. Jeanne stood in the doorway, holding a heavy bucket of fresh water, looking frightened. "What have you done to the nuns?" she said. Caris and Mare burst out laughing, and then Jeanne recognized them. "How you have changed yourselves," she exclaimed. They drank some of the water, and Caris shared out the rest of the smoked fish for breakfast. It was a good sign, she thought as they ate, that Jeanne had not recognized them. If they were careful, perhaps they could get away with this. They took their leave of Jeanne and rode off. As they breasted the rise before Hôpital des Sœurs, the sun came up directly ahead of them, casting a red light on the nunnery, making the ruins look as if they were still burning. Caris and Mare trotted quickly through the village, trying not to think about the mutilated corpse of the nun lying there in the debris, and rode on into the sunrise. Chapter 47. By Tuesday, the 22nd of August, the English army was on the run. Ralph Fitzgerald was not sure how it had happened. They had stormed across Normandy from west to east, looting and burning, and no one had been able to withstand them. Ralph had been in his element. On the march, a soldier could take anything he saw, food, jewelry, women, and kill any man who stood in his way. It was how life ought to be lived. The king was a man after Ralph's own heart. Edward III loved to fight. When he was not at war, he spent most of his time organizing elaborate tournaments, costly mock battles with armies of knights in specially designed uniforms. On the campaign, he was always ready to lead a sortie or raiding party, risking his life, never pausing to balance risks against benefits, like a Kingsbridge merchant. The older knights and earls commented on his brutality and had protested about incidents such as the systematic rape of the women of Cayenne. But Edward did not care. When he had heard that some of the Cayenne citizens had thrown stones at soldiers who were ransacking their homes, he had ordered that everyone in the town should be killed, and only relented after vigorous protests by Sir Godfrey de Harcourt and others. Things had started to go wrong when they came to the River Seine. At Rouen, they had found the bridge destroyed, and the town, on the far side of the water, heavily fortified. King Philippe VI of France was there in person, with a mighty army. The English marched upstream, looking for a place to cross, but they found that Philippe had been there before them, and one bridge after another was either strongly defended or in ruins. They went as far as Poissy, only 20 miles from Paris, and Ralph thought they would surely attack the capital. But older men shook their heads sagely and said it was impossible. Paris was a city of 50,000 men, and they must by now have heard the news from Cayenne,
so they would be prepared to fight to the death, knowing they could expect no mercy. If the king did not intend to attack Paris, Ralph asked, what was his plan? No one knew, and Ralph suspected that Edward had no plan other than to wreak